Schwingen ihrer Haare.
Ladies and gentlemen, once again, another episode of Big Bad Mother Film Review, Bad Mother Film Show.
Is that what it was called?
I can't recall what the
name
show was supposed to be called.
The name has been changed to protect the innocent.
I keep forgetting all the time. First of all, I want to make a little apology right now, if I can. As you recall, last time we were here all together, I stated that Sam Greenlee, the writer of the infamous legendary book, The Spook Who Sat by the Door, which was also made into an infamous legendary film, was going to be my guest. Well, unfortunately, there was a scheduling conflict, and Sam couldn't make it today. He will be rescheduled sometime in March. So in a last-minute desperation bid, I brought back my old friend. Introduce yourself.
This is Ira Harmon again.
That's right. It's us again, folks. You know, we just make ourselves like a team.
Yeah, the regular show, and the third person, if they show up or not, I'll just be here. I have it on confidential information that Sam had to reorganize his sock drawer and shave some lint off his sweaters. And so, you know how it is when you've got to do that. You just can't get away for any engagements. So he's going to have nice, organized, color-coordinated socks and spiffy sweaters next time you see him.
By the way, did I mention this happens to be WHPK 88.5 FM?
No, you didn't mention that yet.
Well, I just said it right now.
Okay.
Before we begin, because there's a certain topic I do want to talk about today, but before we begin, I have several announcements that I want to make. First of all, as you recall, last time was here, this whole film program, black film program that Columbia College is now holding until the first week of March. And on tonight at 6 p.m. at the Hot House, Tim Reed is going to speak, give a lecture, and do a Q&A for anybody. It's free to the public at the Hot House, which is over at 31 West Balbo between Wabash and State Street. And he'll be speaking at 6 o'clock today. As I talk about his films, you know he owns a film studio, which are films that shot this HBO television movie, Iron Jawed Angels, which was shown last night, was shot at Tim Reed's studio in Virginia.
Tim Reed of Frank's Place, Tim Reed?
Yeah.
Tim Reed of WKRP in Cincinnati.
Yeah,
Tim
Venus Flytrap.
Venus Flytrap.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Tim Reed, the sister.
For those out there who have forgotten who Tim Reed is, I just thought I'd bring up his resume.
But he's also a filmmaker, and a film producer and filmmaker, films such as Once Upon a Time We Were Colored, which is a terrific movie.
I've yet to see it.
Take my word for it. It's terrific. There's Asunder, which is sort of like his Fatal Attraction.
See, I'm going to be remiss to get DVD rentals now that Tower Records is closing up or going out of business.
They're not going out of business. They're still staying around.
How are they going to do that?
I don't know. They said some volunteer, kind of hocus pocus trick with mirrors.
What they're probably going to have is interns that don't get paid working in there. Good luck.
That's what they got now. By the way, before we go, and then, so Tim Reed, tomorrow on the 17th, yours truly will be giving a lecture on the image of the black male in American cinema. I'll be doing it at Columbia College at Collins Hall, which is at 624 South State Street. And then tomorrow night, and this is a separate event, Spike Lee. See, I'm hesitant to call him the little cricket, right?
Wasn't that his nickname? No.
That's what Eddie Murphy called him. Spike Lee is going to be in town, and he is going to be doing a speaking. According to this, he's going to be speaking about issues of family, diversity, censorship, film, and filmmaking. And this also will include a question and answer session. It'll be at the Merle Riskin Theater at 60 East Balbo Drive. At 7 p.m. tomorrow night, and it says here the price is from $1 to $10.
No, it comes cheap. Is it going to fill the place with about 50,000 people?
I assume the cheaper prices are for students if you show an ID.
Okay.
They didn't specify here, but I assume that's what it is.
Okay, so he's not doing it for the money per se. He's doing it for a couple of coins to pay for his car fare. And...
Well, you know, he's got that big multi-million-dollar house on Martha's Vineyard, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Probably shoots hoops with Russell Simmons or somebody.
Yeah, you know, they all elite. They all hang out.
Yeah.
I also want to mention that on Wednesday, Tina Andrews, who is one of the most prolific and one of the most successful screenwriters, and really, one of the most successful black women screenwriters is going to be giving a talk on the business behind the show business. This is also at Columbia College, at 12 noon on Wednesday, the film and video department. It doesn't say where, but if you go to www.colum.edu/backhistory, you'll see the schedule, and they will update on where she will speak because they haven't set a place yet. I don't know why.
It could be out in a park on a bench somewhere.
It could be. But so that's a team of several main events. Tim Reed tonight at Hot House. Me tomorrow at 2 p.m. at Collins Hall at the 624 South Wabash. Spike Lee tomorrow night at the Merle Riskin Theater, and then Tina Andrews over on someplace at Columbia College in the film and video department, which is also on Wabash, too.
And I'll be yelling at my cat and my dog sometime at 3 a.m. when they're disturbing my sleep, but no one will be invited to that.
But this is what I want to talk about today, right? This is what I want to do. Like I said, I'm giving this speech tomorrow, this lecture tomorrow, on the image of the black male in American cinema.
Starting with the first starring black actor in a film, Uncle Tom's Cabin. What was his name? I forgot. It's coming on television this week or so, Channel 11.
You kidding me?
Right. Well, I can't think of his name.
Here's the deal. This lecture I'm doing is based on a lecture series I did for the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. It was a 16-week series. I started with Birth of a Nation and ended with Men's to Society. I covered every decade, every major, say, development in the representation of black male image. It was very successful. It was very controversial. The students were very enthused by it. The audience was enthused and angry by it.
Angry by what?
I'll get to that in a minute. And tomorrow I'm giving sort of like a roundabout talk of what I did. Now, I don't know what I'm going to do in 2 hours of dealing with the black male issue, black male image in films, because 2 hours is not enough. 16 weeks is not enough. But I do like to touch on some of these issues today on a black male image. You know, the first film I started with was with Birth of a Nation. Now, for many of you, I'm sure, have heard of Birth of a Nation. Most people have never seen the film. You just know that it's very controversial. You've seen the film.
Yeah, I've seen it.
And it's a picture that, as far as I'm concerned, it was not the first film to have black actors in it. Well, let me rephrase it this way. The major parts in the film, there were black actors in it, but they were extras. Atmosphere, as they call them. The black characters in the film who had major roles were played in white actors in blackface.
Yes.
Which shocked the audience when I saw it. They had no idea.
I mean, it shocked your contemporary audience.
Right. That's what I should say. Shocked the contemporary audience. They had no idea, you know.
Well, they've got a different social inheritance than the people that saw the original showing of the film, so.
By the way, before I forget, if anybody's going to see Spike Lee tomorrow, ask him if it's really true he claims that, you know, he's planning to make the film on Joe Louis.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He claims he's got Vin Diesel signed due to the picture.
Vin Diesel.
Yeah. The idea of Vin Diesel playing a black guy, I'm finally admitting who he is, I find hard to believe.
Well, see, we're trying to break down those barriers in film where you have to have a certain ethnicity to play any particular role. Because, I mean, you've got guys that play women in movies, women that play men, but we haven't crossed any racial barriers yet. Except for movies like, what was the film about the woman who was passing for white...
Imitation of Life.
Imitation of Life.
Yeah, but
right.
Which film? Are you talking about the original version? You're talking about the remake.
Either one.
Everybody knows the remake with Lana Turner.
Right.
Right. Well, the original version starred Claudette Colbert. Claudette Colbert. And the actress who plays the actress who passes for white, in the original version, it was played by a black actress, Freddie Washington, who was very light-skinned and who could pass for white. When they did the remake, they got a white actress to play the part. Susan Kroner, I believe her name was.
Yeah, yeah.
Other
than that film, I don't think there's really that I know of, unless it's been a comedy. There's been several comedies where people have adopted a persona to get something, like, to get through college or to get away from the mob or some other, you know, dubious plot device. Like, those are forgettable movies, and as you can see, I've forgotten what they were called, but a lot of them, it came out recently in the 80s. There was the British Eddie Murphy who did one.
Yeah, True Identity. Lenny Henry.
Yeah, he's been on Channel 11 as some sitcom as a chef.
It was a show as a chef, right? Yeah. That was his big attempt to try to make it to Hollywood, and of course nobody saw it. It was bad.
He tried to jump the puddle, but the vehicle sunk.
Yeah, well, it's hard to make that leap, you know.
He should have flew over here.
Yeah, well, but when I wanted to get back to what I was talking about Birth of a Nation.
Okay.
And needless to say, when I showed this film, first of all, I give all props to the Film Center of the Art Institute of Chicago, the Gene Siskel Film Center, because as far as I was concerned, there was no way I can deal with the image of the black man in film without showing that movie. And it's a controversial film. It was hard to get a print of that film.
Yeah, why?
Either the prints were damaged,
okay.
It couldn't be projected, or I suspect they got scared. Other people who had a print available, I think they got scared. We finally wound up getting a print, actually a gorgeous-looking print, from the George Eastman House. I remember once Roger Ebert told me that he was teaching a class on silent film at Northwestern a couple of years ago, and he tried to show the film and the school refused to show it. They got scared.
See, I don't concur with that kind of censorship.
I don't either.
I mean, you can't bury your head in the sand. If the film was, you know, a seminal film at the time it was made. D.W. Griffith and those guys were inventing the cinematic language at the time they were doing it, also making controversial subjects, bringing those to the screen. And then to just say, well, we don't like the subject matter, and then bury it, I think, is wrong.
Well, also, the other thing, too, is the fact that it is a film that, in terms of development of the language of filmmaking, is absolutely important. There's nothing in that film in terms of his use of editing, camera movement. There's nothing in the film that's new. It's just how he used it, which was revelatory. You know, nobody had ever put together a film that way before.
You mean Sergei Eisenstadt? Eisenstadt is the photographer,
Eisenstein,
the Russian guy. Everyone
that was later. Those films he made, like Potemkin and October, those were later.
That's right. D.W. Griffith was a bit.
Wrath of Nature was done in 1915. You know, a lot of Italian cinema at the time, like Quo Vadis, the original Quo Vadis, Cabrera, used some of the same techniques, but not the way how Griffith used them. Right? It was 1915 as well. You know, it's pretty early. Wrath of Nature was the first. It was the first feature film made in the United States.
Were they still perforating the film stock themselves? You know, they used to have those machines.
I'm not sure about that. They probably were.
Put the perforations
they
in
to
even get it through the camera.
So, like I said, it was a very controversial. There was tension and I had to show it. I had two showings because the film is so long. It's almost 3.5 hours. At least I had to show the film in half, the first part, then the second part, and. You can feel the tension in the air because people were nervous. You know, what are they going to see? They just know it's controversial. Of course, one of the big controversies is not only the image of how black men are portrayed, but also the fact that the Ku Klux Klan is the hero of the movie. They're the big heroes at the end who get rid of all the evil black men, you know, and save white womanhood, you know.
So that was the precursor to Cops, the show.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so far we're keeping it clean. We're going to go in the gallows, but we're keeping it clean.
Bad boys.
So anyway, and of course the controversy was that I even got this letter of protest.
Yeah? Signed by an angry horde or just one person?
No, signed by this group. I can't remember the name of the group, but they're based over here, right a block down the street, over here on 57th and University.
It's a group.
There's some political action group based on this church is over here on 57th and University.
Neo-political activists.
Yeah, they sent me a nasty, well, I don't say nasty, that's the wrong word, but he sent me a very angry 3-page letter.
And after you read this the fuse out.
Yeah. Telling me that how dare I show this movie, that the film is offensive, which is why I showed the picture. You know, that the Klan is the hero of the film. Yeah, I know that, you know, and that evidently a reason I'm showing this film because I have no history of what black people have suffered, that I have no knowledge of who the Klan are. If the Klan is, the Klan are.
Well, see, they made your argument right there. If they said you had no history, then you could say.
No knowledge of history.
No knowledge of history, then you could argue, well, that's because I was never shown this movie before.
Ah, very good. Very good. I didn't think of that.
Well, in most arguments like that where they're begging the question don't hold water anyway.
How come you just come with those answers after the event? I can't come with them before.
That's those in the shower answers. I should have said this. Yeah. Too late now.
So what happens is that we show the film, and I don't care about what anybody. And the great thing about the letter was that at the end it said, what was it? What the last comment at the end? It said, "We implore you not to show the film, but to discuss the images in the movie." Well, how am I going to do that if I don't show the picture?
Well, that's like us doing a fashion show here on the radio. Oh, yeah, look at that. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, too bad you can't see it.
Yeah. Oh, you should have seen this one scene in this movie. Too bad I can't show it to you. And, of course, the audience, they were truly amazed by what they saw, you know, by the film. The black images, the way how black men have been portrayed, basically the three basic characters. The coon, Tom, and the black buck. And what I argue is that those three basic stereotypes, those three basic characters, you will find in movies throughout the decades, even today.
Oh, yeah. There's always going to, you know, because of the expediency of telling a story in a short time period, you have to use stereotypes so that the audience can move on with the plot devices in the story. So Hollywood relies on stereotypes. Say, this is the villain. This is the good guy. You don't have any expose of the character much beyond that. You introduce them and you get on with the story. It's just that some stereotypes are bad because they're steeped in propaganda, and others just simply serve the story.
See, but the other thing is that now we have adopted, I'm talking about black people, we have adopted these stereotypes as representation of authentic blackness.
Authentic blackness?
Yeah. For example, the black buck, right?
Well, you see, the way I look
Let me verify it. The black buck. Wouldn't you argue to me that many rappers today are nothing more than modern-day versions of the big evil black buck that you saw in D.W. Griffith's movie?
Well, yeah, once you've developed a mythology, it can wear whatever clothes you put on it, but the underlying mythology still touches the core, whether you're aware of it or not. And if that's what they're doing, and it's always served a purpose, in this case, selling records. And since most rap records do sell in white suburbia more than they do in urban areas.
I debate that. I don't know. I always hear that, but...
No, rap has surpassed pop as the number one music in terms of sales overall.
I thought it was Clay Aiken.
Nah. Well, does he grab himself when he sings?
He can't find anything. Oh, see, there we go.
There we go.
Baggy pants. Couldn't resist. You gave it to me. I had to go with it.
So that's what all that fumbling around is about on stage. No, but yeah, you know, the mythologies that we place in all stories and in all iconography that we've had since the dawn of the caveman days and the paintings on the walls, you know, it hasn't gone away. Spielberg and Lucas know this for a fact. All of their successful films are steeped in mythological roots, and, you know, we buy it. We buy into that. Those are the same stories told around a campfire over and over again. You got to have the same stereotypical characters to get the story told. And the rapper is just another, you know, transmogrification or whatever the word is for that particular stereotype.
Now, for example, when I talk about Breath of a Nation, there's a character, when I talk about the black buck, there's a character in the film, one of the bad guys, evil bad guys. His name is Gus.
The evil doer.
Right, Gus, right? he's identified as Gus the Renegade Negro.
Oh, I know him.
Yeah, you know, I think everybody knows
the
Gus.
He lived across the alley, yeah.
Everybody knows the Gus.
Gus the Renegade Negro.
I said, but ain't no kind of Negro like those Renegade Negroes.
That's the only kind of Negro to be. You have more fun being a renegade.
So he's this union in the character. Of course, he's played by a guy in blackface, a white guy in blackface. He's this evil, you know.
What was his motivation for being a renegade Negro if it was a white guy in blackface?
Well, the idea being it was like the freedom. The film tries to suggest that, you know, all these evil, that the Civil War and gave all our nice, quiet, traditional, you know, no troubled Negroes, give this idea of freedom and turned them crazy, turned them violent, turned them into, like, hedonistic monsters.
On that note, the movie's flawed as propaganda. On that note, because it was the actually the German settlers were the first moral whipping boys of anti-slavery it wasn't out of sheer moralistic high ground. It was just that they were further north than the plantation workers, and they were using free labor in terms of getting their work done. And they just didn't think slavery, you know, was something that we needed. But were circumstances different and they were south, they might have had, out of necessity of commerce, taken up the same position and said, yeah, give me a bolt full, please. But long before that Birth of a Nation thing, you know, there was dissent. There was one slave freed by court in Massachusetts. The first freed slave was in Massachusetts, of all places, long before the Civil War. I forget his name, but... It had to do with England and Massachusetts coming to terms with anti-slavery sentiments. And he walked into court as an escaped slave and walked out a free man. And that was long before slavery even got into full swing. That was within the first 50 years,
of slavery.
Before they realize, hey, wait a minute, what are we doing?
Yeah, well, I forget the name. The guy's name was a French guy that said, my Indians are not handling the slavery thing too good. Can you get me some Africans?
Well, gosh, who was the name? Now we get into history lesson, but it was a Portuguese priest.
Yeah, Portuguese.
Who actually started the idea of using black people as slaves because the Indians were dying off.
Well, I'm sure it's just like any other moment in history. There were several guys with the same idea, and it depends on who you go with.
One thing, though, before we continue this, because I want to talk more about Gus, I do have to make this announcement. If you're a male 45 or older, talk to your doctor about getting tested for prostate cancer. If not for yourself, then for your family. For more information, call the American Cancer Society at 1-800-ACS-2345 or visit www.cancer.org. Once again, that's the American Cancer Society at 1-800-ACS-2345 or visit www.cancer.org.
Hey, don't they have a new method for probing now?
I wouldn't know.
I understand they don't have
I wouldn't know.
I don't think they have to violate you so bad anymore to
Ooh,
check.
What are you doing? See, I told you, they're trying to keep you clean to this time.
That was medicinal. That was
Look, ladies and gentlemen.
That was clinical. That was scientific.
You know, we can't have a 5-minute conversation without going graphic.
Well, on the radio, you have to be graphic because you don't have a camera or a lens. So you have to,
that's true, yeah.
You have to describe everything. You know.
But this character, let me get back to Gus for a second. Now, this character, Gus.
The
right?
renegade Negro.
The renegade Negro. The infamous scene is when one of the major characters, this white girl, whose name I cannot slip my mind now,
she
sees
actress.
Her.
Right, and he goes...
He goes nuts.
He goes buck wild.
He goes buck wild, right? And he chases her through the forest, right? And finally, she gets to the edge of a cliff, and she jumps off.
Well, she knew he was a renegade Negro when she saw him coming, right?
He's wearing his uniform.
His renegade Negro uniform?
No, yeah, his Union uniform. He was an ex-soldier, right?
Oh, Buffalo Soldier type guy.
No, Buffalo Soldiers were later.
I know.
So she jumps off a cliff, right? And that...
Bungee jumping?
Huh?
Bungee jumping?
No, no bungee. This
no, just straight off the cliff.
Hits the rocks, right? And you know, she rather would kill herself than to
be,
you know,
savaged by a renegade.
Savaged by this beast, right? You know... She just, you know, she didn't want, you know.
Had it been a renegade anything else, it would have been like, hey.
You're right.
I got some cold wine chilling in the brook.
And of course,
in the
film, that eventually, one thing leads to another, that leads to the Klan coming up and being the heroes, right? When the film came out, Klan membership increased.
In Indiana, especially. No, that's okay. I didn't...
Well, yeah.
Indiana's residents notwithstanding, they're good citizens of Indiana.
So what happens is that I've been trying to show for all these years that the image has continued on. These images, the coon, the buck, the tom, all these images have just continued in various forms over the years, right? And as a result, this was a very controversial issue.
So you know, these people that were adverse to you showing that film, they probably still watch Good Times reruns.
They probably do. And see, no problem with that. They have no problem watching Martin.
Martin,
but they have a problem with Reservoir Nation. I don't see the difference. Now, I tell you something else too. There was a conversation talking about the male image, right? There was a conversation when, you know, was this game called Ghettoopoly?
Yeah.
You know, with the idea of you sell a form of monopoly. You sell as much drugs as you can to make all the money, right?
Right, and instead the icons are little pimp hats
and you know,
and
I brought this up during a discussion after one of the films, and people were objecting about it. I said, but the problem is that Jay-Z on his website has a video game which is exactly similar. You had this character, he's got to go around selling crack, and at the end, who wins? It's a video game. And the people were shocked. They go, that's not true. And I said, absolutely true. Look it up. So what's the difference between Ghettoopoly and what's the difference between what Jay-Z does on his website?
Yeah, well,
they had
know,
no answer for that, because there is no difference.
Double standards.
Right, you know, because Ghettoopoly was created by an Asian.
An Asian guy, yeah.
Right. And it's okay Jay-Z does it because he's a brother?
When I first heard about it, I thought, that's quaint. I mean, everyone's joked about that game. This Asian guy just decided to actually take it to market.
Yeah.
I mean, we've all joked about, we should have a monopoly with
you
guys.
Or he just mad because somebody came up with the idea first.
Or actually acted on the idea.
Acted on the idea.
Ideas go to everybody. It's just right. whether you act on it or not. But, yeah, I've heard of it. And actually, I thought I'd buy one just to have it, you know, but they got yanked before I could do that. So.
No, I should have brought it on when it had it, was it out.
The naysayers and the censors and all of these people, you know. Like, what is that organization in Texas that takes all the textbooks, like Catcher in the Rye, reading, you know, all the good novels out of the school system?
There is?
Yeah, yeah. They're like a right-wing organization, and they have a lot of power in terms of what a publisher can sell to the school system in a wide area, geographic area. So
in Texas.
No, they're root. Their main organization is in Texas, but their influence covers multiple states. And if they don't like a book, it doesn't get into the schools, and the publisher doesn't make any money. So if they don't want that book there, then it's not there. Just like the Paramount decree, you know, to get back on the film subject, you know, where we had to self-police the they self-police themselves. Oh, a little bit of history about Paramount. You know, Ringling Brothers, what was the oldest brother of the Ringling Brothers Circus? He built a theater up in Wisconsin.
Uh-huh.
And Balvin and Katz here in Chicago saw that theater, and they started to build the palaces, the last of which is a Chicago theater. And they joined with another company, which eventually became Paramount,
which was created by Ido Zukor.
Yeah, which brings me back to the Paramount decree where they had to self-police themselves. And that also brings up another note of stereotypes. What was that? There was a Jewish stereotype family that
the Goldbergs.
The Goldbergs. They would trot them out when anti-Semitism was at an all-time high to make everyone laugh and not worry about, you know, the Jewish problem, so to speak. Then after they were the nervousness and the goose-stepping went away, they would ferret the Goldbergs back into the closet. We haven't seen or heard from them since.
No, it was a TV show for a while. It was a TV. I assume you're talking about the Goldbergs, right?
Right, the Goldbergs, right.
Yeah, it was a TV show. It was a popular TV show in the early 50s.
Highly stereotypical.
Yeah, but you know what? I tell you something that was interesting. I told you this group protested my showing of the movie.
Right.
Resignation. And he said in the letter, if I was doing a series on the Jewish image, the image of how Jews have been portrayed in films, I wouldn't show films with stereotyped Jews.
So you wouldn't show the Goldbergs, they're saying.
You know, absolutely. I mean, if I'm going to deal with any kind of subject matter where a race of people, a culture of people, the way they've been portrayed in films, in the media, I have to deal with the good and the bad. I have to deal with the positive and the negative. So yes, I would show the Goldbergs. I would show Yentl. I would even show some of the Nazi films that were made during that period, because you know the way how Jewish people had unfairly been portrayed in films. Same thing with black image, the black male. If I'm going to deal with black males, I got to show the positive. I got to show the negative. The positive with films like I show like Nothing But a Man, films like Flaw's Big Ripoff, and show the negative. You know, stuff like I showed the race films from the 40s, films like Broken Strings, where you have. Here you have, it was written by Clarence Muse, right? He was an actor who almost an entire life played stereotype roles. He played slaves. He played some really degrading characters in movies, right? A lot of times he always seemed to be next to a horse, right?
Was
or
there
a mule.
Comparison going on there?
Right. No, like, I told you, keep it clean. What's the matter with you? So he writes this movie called Broken Strings, one of the race films made in the 40s, these low-budget independent films that were made for the black audience, the segregated black audience in movie theaters, where he plays a concert musician, a violinist, a classical violinist. There's no way in the world he was going to play a part like that in a Hollywood movie. He had to do it himself, you know, write his own script, right? So I deal with a positive, I deal with a negative, which means resignation, which means, you know, what other films I showed, you know.
The yin and yang of it all.
Right. And a lot of people, I was criticized as the way you're showing negative images. Well, if I try to show positive images of a black man, I got 5 movies. You know, I mean, what I got. I'm sorry. You know, I was criticized by some people showing that the films I showed were too violent. Films like, well, saw his big ripoff or Menace to Society. And I said, well, that goes to saying that, goes back to that stereotype that black men are violent, uncontrollable. You know, we cannot, you know, handle our emotions.
Well, as long as there's dissent regarding the arts, we know that the arts are doing their job. Because the minute it's like, oh, gee, I had nothing to protest about that art. It just kind of was like flavorless Jell-O. Then there's no reason to do any art.
Before we continue, I just want to say that beside our show, please listen to Getting Trash with Lindsay. Getting Trash with Lindsay. Getting Trash with Lindsay. For the best thing, try this again. Getting Trash with Lindsay. For the best thing, garage, trash, 60 rock and roll, power pop, and late 70s punk. What's power pop?
I don't know, just a catchphrase.
Well, you see, listen to the show and you can find out. Tune in every other Monday night, Tuesday morning from 12 a.m. to 2 a.m. Shake your donkey and your martini. Only on WHPK 88.5 FM. I got to listen to the show to find out what power pump is and what do you mean by shaking my donkey.
Power pump or power pop?
Power pop.
Power pop. Well, you know what Ellington told Dizzy Gillespie when he came up with the sound that was dubbed bebop. He was like, oh, man, you should have never let them put a name on it. Because now that they've named you, they're going to categorize you out of existence.
Yeah, well, I remember something else Duke Ellington said, but I have to tell you that after the show. Something he said once.
Well, it wasn't a mixed company, huh?
No, it wasn't a mixed company. See, that's the other side of Duke Ellington.
The Duke.
But, you know, what were we talking about? We're just, once again, talking about this idea of the male image. If you want to know more about this, I'm going to be speaking about this tomorrow at 2 p.m., starting at 2 p.m. at Collins Hall at Columbia College.
I should, since you did that public service announcement, that was a PSA, right?
Yeah.
I should mention that if you haven't gone to www.harmonart.com, that you should point your browsers there just to see what's up.
And also, I do want to say, as a little extra bonus, tune in this coming Sunday for a tune-up with Ricky Thomas. His show, his jazz show, is a great jazz show. Great jazz show on here on WHBK from 8 to 10 a.m. It's a terrific show. I listen to it every – he's on this Sunday. He's on every other Sunday, and it's terrific. I've learned a lot about jazz listening to his show.
I should have spelled my website, harmonart.com.
Why don't you just spell it?
Why didn't I just spell it?
Yeah.
I just did.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't paying attention. So you're talking about yourself. I wasn't paying attention.
Okay. Now, the next sound you hear will be us tussling in here.
Yeah, but anyway, I want to get back to this whole thing about the black man image because I just think, I chose the subject because it's the most controversial subject I can think of. You know? And believe me, it did get heated. One guy, even the audacity, had the audacity to say that I wasn't black enough.
Okay, it's kind of...
He said, I wasn't from the corner. That's exactly what he said. I wasn't from the corner. You know what? I'm not.
You should have said, well, I was there, but my 40 got empty, so I booked up to get some change.
That's when you know you really hit a nerve, right?
When somebody
says that, you're not from the corner.
You can get
you don't understand
shot
what like.
Standing on the corner.
Right.
I don't want to hang out on the corner.
I got better things to do.
There's always the alley. There's an option.
Yeah, right.
Get more stuff done in the alley than
that's
on the
right,
corner.
That's right, because I'm now from the corner,
you
right?
You can hop a fence if the fuzz pull up.
That's why when we showed Menace to Society,
uh-huh.
You know, and he misinterpreted what I said, that I said it wasn't, I know, I said, do you think, and I always like to challenge the audience, do you think this is a unrealistic portrayal of black men? That's what I said. Somehow he misinterpreted saying that I said this was an unrealistic portrayal of black men.
So he thought that... He thought that vilification of black men in the film was authentic.
Yeah. See, that's why it goes back to what I was talking about in that these images have been so repeated over and over again, has been so drummed into our heads that now we begin to accept them as reality, as the truth, that these are the way our men are.
The black pathology business.
Right, exactly. And we bought into that, and now we consider that what I call, for lack of a better expression, authentic blackness.
Yeah, well, if you take your cues from the films for anything in real life, you're going to be in for a rude awakening.
And unfortunately, that's what most people do. Let me tell you an example that happened about a year and a half ago, right? I was asked by a group of people to, let me rephrase it this way. the Chicago Public Schools was having this program where they had students read books. And then fiction novels, and then see a film version of the movie, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And stuff like, you know, the usual To Kill a Mockingbird, that sort of thing.
Right.
So I was asked to introduce a screening of one of these movies, you know. And I was going to introduce another film. At the last minute, there had to be a change. I had to take over somebody else, you know, for another movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what the movie was. I was told the night before I got there. And the movie was Sounder. Okay, I hate Sounder. I despise Sounder with every fiber in my being.
Cicely Tyson.
Right? Yeah, and Kevin Hooks and Paul Winfield.
Paul Winfield.
About the poor black family.
The skinny Paul Winfield, not the
well-fed.
Yeah,
very, very skinny, right.
Paul Winfield.
A poor black family in the 1930s in Depression in the Delta, Mississippi Delta, and their struggles. Right? And Sounder is the name of the dog that this kid has. All right? So I hate this film. I mean, I'll get into this movie why I hate it. I just hate this picture. And so I'm in the theater. This is the next morning. I'm in the theater at the Field Museum. I'm waiting for the students to come in. And I don't know what to expect, right? And they come in, and it's all black and Hispanic students. You know, so I have to go up there in front of this crowd and tell them why I think this is a really wonderful movie.
Sounder?
Yeah.
So you had
because they're reading the book. I got to tell them.
You had to do a little prevarication
and
there.
And I'm like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? You know, I just and I just realized I just can't lie. I can't go up in front of these students and tell them this is a wonderful movie. Right. So I got up in front of the audience. It's several hundred people. Students, right, and teachers. And I said to them, I said, look, I have to tell you the truth. You don't want me to come up here and tell you what a wonderful movie this is. This movie is terrible. It's garbage. This movie lies to you. And I said, how many people think that movies reflect reality? Right? Almost everybody raised up their hand. Right? And I told them, I said, you know, they're kids, right? High school kids. And I said, no, films are fantasy. They are lies. Godard makes that statement, cinema is truth 24 frames per second. No, movies are lies 24 frames per second.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that is good to keep in mind is that the difference between real life and fiction is that fiction has to make sense.
Yeah, well, you see, sound doesn't make sense. See? And I explained to them, but one of the reasons I hate the movie so much, one of the main reasons is that the movie tells a lie about what it was like to live in the South at that time. Okay, we have this poor family, okay, they're living in the Mississippi Delta, okay, and they're starving. You didn't starve if you lived in the Mississippi Delta in that period. That land, not today because of pollution, but that land back then was some of the most fertile land in the country. Everybody who lived in that area had their own gardens, raised their own, you know, chickens, you know, poultry, pigs.
Played the blues.
pigs. There was wild game everywhere, geese, duck, you know, wild turkey. I mean, you were poor, but you were well fed, right? And this idea that this father goes to prison because he steals food to feed his family is a complete lie. This is somebody who has never lived there, who doesn't know anything about the area, is a complete lie. And I told the students how movies lie to you. Don't take these movies as the gospel.
They're only there to serve the story and the premise and the theme, whatever that might be.
So when I was finished, talk about smattering of applause. They were like, right.
They were like,
and they all had this look in the face, like,
they're like,
stunned.
He ripped apart our cozy assumptions, and we don't know what to do now.
You know, and I just said, well, they'll never hide. They'll never ask me to speak again. It was like dead silence, right?
Yeah, they
were just stunned.
You gave him a lobotomy. That's
yeah.
What happened.
And I remember walking up the stage, and the guy who set up the whole thing, I said, oh, boy, he's going to rip me a new one, right? And he goes up there, and he shakes my hand. He goes like, That was terrific. You spoke from the heart. You spoke from the heart. It was so wonderful, right? But films are lies, you know? And when you come, especially when you're dealing with a black image, boy, we're talking about some real whoppers.
One of the first thing out of my instructor's mouth when I was at film school at SAIC, he said, let me tell you, the first thing you should know about film is that film is a lie. Yeah. You can lie with film like you can't lie with any other medium out there. And then I sat up in my seat. Lies? This is interesting. A little touch of larceny.
See, and that's what happened particularly, I think, with younger filmgoers. Or just younger people who it's been saturated by the media. Believe me, they're more saturated by the media than we were. Right?
Yeah, true.
And it's like they believe everything is the truth now. They believe everything is like that. They want to be like that. They want to be the rappers with the gold and the women. Look, you know, last week there was a panel here at the University of Chicago about black women directors and the image how women are portrayed in hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept, you know, and I should have had the courage to speak up.
You mean
kept,
the black women directors and the bitches and hoes of hip hop?
Yeah, right. Hip hop, right? Yeah. I don't know how those two really work together, right? And I wanted to say, too, they were talking about why is this image of black women in these music videos so prevalent? You know, the hoochie mamas with the thong bikinis and this and that. And, you know, I wanted to say, look, you got these guys who are basically losers and nerds, you know, who finally they're making, you know, whatever little money they're making after the record label
after the record label rips them a nice one,
right? And so this is their fantasy. Duh, I can understand that. You know, I mean, come on, this is reality. You know, I was thinking like a guy. Guys say, hey, finally I can get some women.
Right? Big, I'm gonna get some women and an allowance. And I'm not going to learn about publishing or owning the rights to my music.
Right.
And then when I'm no longer the flavor of the week, it's back to the unenjoyment line.
I had another experience once about three, four years ago. I spoke to some students at South Shore High School. And, I mean, they have really no idea of the reality of the business. I'm talking about films. I wanted to speak about film.
Well, we've lost a sense of history with this generation.
I wanted to speak about film, but it went to media and records, and they have no concept. They think that every person who records an album is a millionaire overnight. They think that people who appear on television, even a bit part, get some kind of huge salary and, you know,
well, you know,
driving a role.
Freshman year of high school, sometimes did an article on me and my work, and everybody at school was trying to borrow $50 off me. Oh, we know you got a lot of money because we saw you on TV and in the magazine. I was like, moron.
Right. It doesn't work like that.
Doesn't work like that. But that's the way it goes. You know, you think that the group Outkast, they have a song on one of the earlier albums, and the title of the song, I think, is Atliens. And in the lyrics of the rap, they're talking about meeting kids from high school that they knew who think that they're wealthy now because they're putting out music. And he's like, hey, I'm in the rap, he says, I'm living song to song like you live check to check. If I don't have a hit, I don't eat. So I'm in this for the long haul.
Yeah, that's after the record label still rips off.
Right, after I get out of the hole with the record label and can produce myself, then I might make some money.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised how many of these recording artists are on the verge of bankruptcy or haven't made a dime. Some of them have already declared bankruptcy.
Well, if they're not producing, producers get paid first no matter what.
Right.
And then everyone else, the record company recoups their expenses. And then if there's anything left, the artist might get an allowance to buy a sandwich.
Yeah, that's
and
about
then, it. And they're on the hook contractually to get back out there and dance on the string.
Before we continue, I just want to mention that the Chicago Department of Transportation is committed to encouraging bicycling in the city of Chicago. Projects include establishing 20 miles of new bike lanes. You still ride your bike, right?
Yeah.
Adding 250 new bike racks to what is already the largest number of bike racks in the nation. Is that true? You're right. Identifying future off-street trails, establishing bike parking at three CTA stations, and enhancing the Department of Transportation website to provide a full range of online services. Cyclists can learn about bicycling commuting, suggest locations for new bike racks, view online version of the Chicago bike map, and register their bicycles at www.chicagobikes.org.
Yeah, I saw a kid try to put his bike on the front rack of the bus once. I was on the bus.
And it fell out?
No, the bus driver wouldn't let him because you have to be over 17 years old in order for them to take your bike and put it on the rack.
Well, you have to be that old.
I don't know, but the kid got pissed off and threw a beer bottle at the bus.
There you go.
And we all had to duck.
There you go.
and also, if there's going to be that much bike stuff going on, everyone should know that if you, well, if I say this, then all the thugs will know to look for it.
Maybe I shouldn't say it. You better not say it.
It's just a way of retrieving your bicycle. Well, thugs aren't listening to this station.
That's right.
So I'll go ahead and tell you. You could put your personal information on a piece of paper, your name, address, phone number, et cetera, pertinent information and details, roll it up, put it down inside the frame of the bike. That way, if your bike is stolen and painted a different color, you can still look inside the tube of the bike frame and find the information to prove that that is your property.
Now, don't you know that the only people who listen to this are nothing but thugs? Don't you know that?
I know. They're sitting
now
around.
Now I can tell you the truth.
They're sitting around bagging it, weighing it, whacking it up, and listening to this station in their thug abode.
Well, let me ask you this. Let me ask you this, okay? We touched on this already. Right? But just generally, why do you think that? See, look, when I dealt with black male image in film, I knew it was controversial. I wanted to be controversial. It was. It got very heated at times. I was told this last week. It was the most enthusiastic response they've ever had from people at the Gene Siskel Film Center, any kind of lecture series. You know, there were people who were just dying to participate in the lecture. You know, and why does that subject do that? I mean, what is it about when you're dealing with the black image in films? It elicits that kind of emotions.
Well, it's the most maligned image in all media, for one. And it's been beat over our heads with the 6 o'clock news and every film that they've got out there. Whenever you see a black character in a film, you hope that he lives through the first 15 minutes of the movie. Because when the monster comes out of the sewer hole and eats up half the city, the first person he's going to eat is the black guy who sacrifices himself to let everybody else live on to the end of the movie. If he's not sacrificing himself to the monster, then he is the monster. But he can't be the hero because that's an uncomfortable thing. He can't be a romantic lead because that flies in the face of all the fear that exists that keeps the black man's image maligned in the first place.
Well, you know what? I'm trying to think of a movie where a black character does live. I'm trying to think.
Well, if a Jim Brown movie, yeah. No.
When you have a group of, you know, different... I'm talking about when he's the lead. I'm talking about, like, different characters.
Oh,
like
Eight-Legged Freaks.
In what?
Eight-Legged Freaks.
See, I can't remember that thing. I saw it and I forgot as soon as I saw it. one that sticks out to me.
It had Dougie Doug in it as
but the one that sticks out to me, the one that sticks out to me, I don't know why. It always sticks out to me is Force 10 from Navarone.
Oh, yeah.
Or Carl Weathers from Rocky.
Yeah.
And, you know, he plays this guy who joins up with the other guys to blow up this huge Nazi fortress, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a big fight scene with the guy who played Jaws in, like...
Force 10 from Navarone. That's the long-awaited 10-year sequel to Guns of Navarone.
Right, okay. With Harrison Ford, right?
Right.
And he plays the big guy, played Jaws in the James Bond films, Richard Kyle, right?
Right.
And you think, oh, boy, the brother's going to get it. No, he kills it. The brother lives, right? He gets it. You're like, that's unusual.
Right, it's like, how'd that
he
happen?
He lived. How'd that happen?
How did that happen?
Because everybody thinks, oh, well, this is where the brother gets
right,
killed.
Right, right.
Might as well go get some popcorn.
It's like, it was nice seeing you, but I know you got to die now. It's been 15 minutes.
Right.
That's way too much screen time.
And I'm just like, you know, it's sort of like, what's a good word for the image, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, if you watch a game show, like Jeopardy, there's a black personality, you go right. Like, I sure hope he does well. You know, not even winning. Just do well.
Well, you know, when my mom would take me to the theater to see movies when I was a kid, and now that I'm looking back on it, I was affected by the fact that the one black image I'd see on the screen usually got killed off, you know, before the movie was over. I'm thinking of Devil at 4 o'clock with Spencer Tracy, Frank Sinatra, etc. And there was Frank Sinatra had a buddy in the film, played by a black actor whose name I forget because he got killed too soon anyway.
Uh-huh.
When the volcano strikes and they're trying to cross in a passage and a gigantic timber comes down or something, he catches this so that everyone else can continue on the path. And then at the last minute, the volcano shimmies and shakes again, and he's impaled by the... And how many brothers get impaled, you know, the spear chucker syndrome, you know, you have to impale them with a spear.
Well, you know what, you even look at films today, the film that all the critics are raving about, In America, you know, by Jim Sheridan. All the critics are raving about this film. Believe me, it's eh. All the critics, you know, about this Irish... illegal alien, you know, they snuck into the United States trying to make it, right? And they befriend, they're living in this rundown apartment building.
What time frame is this?
It's supposed to be, you see, the thing about they purposely make it ambiguous, but it's supposed to be, I'm taking a guess, 80s, maybe mid-80s to early 90s. But they kind of...
Of the last century.
Yeah.
So it has nothing to do with
decade.
That has nothing to do with the potato famine.
No, last decade. No, they drive it and everything. Okay. So they befriend this this tortured black man who lives at the apartment below. He's this tortured artist who happens to be dying of AIDS. Right?
So that doesn't mean he's gay or anything. He just got a bad transfusion or something.
Well, they don't explain it. He's introduced to the movie, you hear him screaming.
Hmm.
You know, it's like in a movie, it's like you hear this character, you hear like off screen. Oh!
Is there like an empty can of Crisco out by, by the back?
You know, why is he screaming? He's this tortured, right? And of course he dies at the end. But before he dies, he leaves all his money to them.
Oh, okay.
You know, which enables them to pay off all their bills and their hospital bills and their debts. Once again, he is really no difference than the characters we've seen over and over
again. So he's a magic Negro in this one.
Yeah, right. He's the magic Negro who sacrifices his life at the end for the benefit of the white family. Huh. And it's the same thing. And by the way, the actor who plays this part, Dimsen Hansu. You know, he's been nominated for an Oscar.
Is that he from the Spielberg movie?
He's been nominated for an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. Best Supporting Actor.
I heard about that nomination.
And it's the same character. It's the same character you talk about, the Devil at 4 o'clock.
Lilies of the Field.
It's the same character. See, these images, that's what I want to say, is that these images keep continuing all the time.
Well,
in different variations, but they keep continuing all the time.
In order to get a new mythology, you have to erase the current cultural landscape and start all over again because, you know, these myths are just going to be ingrained forever. You know, the greatest genius in the world can't escape their own cultural inheritance. It's just, you know, the founding fathers, for all of their ingeniousness, were flawed. They put together a nice country. They didn't figure on, you know, the ability to steal elections or the ability of political parties to rise to prominence. They didn't figure in all that. With all of their genius, they overlooked these things. So, like, because of the cultural inheritance, these things hadn't existed before. So the same thing with mythology in our stories. We're going to have to go back to the caveman days and start all over again.
And I should also add, ladies and gentlemen, the reason why Ira is so articulate, more so than I will ever be, on this, because he is a writer. He is an artist. He is...
And I went to school and I read a book.
That's right. Which is more than I can say for myself. But before we go, I just want to emphasize once again, don't forget Tim Reed tonight at the Hot House at 6 p.m. Tomorrow I'm speaking on this very same subject. I hope anybody out there is listening can make it. It's free, too. I'll be tomorrow at 2 p.m., from 2 to 4 p.m. at Collins Hall at 624 South Wabash at Columbia College. Spike Lee tomorrow night at 7 at the Merle Riskin Theater at 60 East Balbo. And then Tina Andrews, the screenwriter who wrote Sally Hemings, the miniseries, and is right now currently working on a major miniseries for CBS on the life of Jackie Kennedy. Sorry, not Jackie Kane. She already wrote that one. The one, Coretta Scott King. That's the one she's working on now.
Yeah.
And she'll be there, Columbia College, on Wednesday at 12 noon. Any final comments?
Yeah, I have a few. But first, I'd like to say that website again is www.harmonart1word.com.
And Russell, once again, I really, really appreciate you coming here at the very last minute.
I got one thing to ride out on. Remember you talked about that movie about the Irish immigrants?
In
America. Now, Ireland is a peninsula. It's just got water all around it.
Yes, an island.
So if there was a potato famine, what, nobody likes fish? What's the story there?
I don't know. Don't ask me. I don't know.
Just curious.
I don't know.
You know, at my age, I'm looking at things from, you know, from my own perspectives. And I'm wondering, so what's up? You know, you could have a menu. You could change the menu a little.
Don't start me. Don't start. Because I'm thinking, gee, all those people in India are starving. They got all these cows everywhere.
Right. They got cows.
You think? Don't
put them on the menu.
Now we're going to get complaints. Now people are going to be upset. And then,
have to worry about mad cow disease if they come from Britain.
Yeah. But once again, I thank you so much for doing this the very last minute. I really, really appreciate this.
No problem.
You're a lifesaver. Sam Greenlee. He will be rescheduled.
But right now he's on the no thanks list.
Yeah, well, had so much to talk to him about. We will talk with Mr. Greenlee sometime next month. We will have to reschedule it. But once again, thank you so much.
No problem. So you're going to go out on some cool music? How about something from James Brown? Maybe I know you got soul. That's Bobby Bird, actually.
I know, but
yeah,
I think
you don't have that cut.
No, but I think I got.
Have you ever heard this French guy do that Afropop show?
Afropop?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen it.
That's pretty good.
Well, look, we got to go. It's time to for us to leave, ladies and gentlemen. So until then, until next time, I'll see you.
And read a book.
Oh, and now it's time for old folk songs?
The old songs.
The old songs.
The old songs. Yes.
I'll get that title right one day. Until next time, folks.
Thank you, Sergio. It was an interesting show.
What about the air?
Hmm?
Got some...
Still in the air?